we continue with the 15th chapter. We're discussing the second section, which talks about transmigration. So we discuss 15.7 of how the soul who forgets Krishna, doesn't surrender to Krishna, continues on in material existence. And then we discuss 15.8, which talks about how the soul continues. So Vayur Gandha Nivashayat. So this example of Vayu and Gandha, I was explaining that Gandha, first of all, Vayu itself is subtle. We don't see wind, we feel it. And Gandha is fragrance. That's something which is not perceivable directly again with our eyes. We just feel it again with a different sense. But we know that one subtle object, almost subtle, wind is not totally subtle, but one not so easily perceivable object carries another not so perceivable object. Vayur Gandha Nivashayat. Similarly, the soul, which is not perceivable to us, carries conceptions. So that's what is talked about. Vayur Gandha Nivashayat. Was there something which I was going to talk about, Manish Prabhu, at the start of this class? There's some question which we left off in the, or some point which. No. Something which we left off in the afternoon class, which we're supposed to complete. Anyway, okay, nothing is there. So now. Right. So, you know, all over the world, there have always been thinkers who have come up with different metaphors to talk about how this existence, our present existence, is in some ways unreal or insubstantial or artificial. This has been an insight which comes up for thinkers in many ways. Now, one way could be that when we see somebody who is right there among us and suddenly that person dies. So, you know, we take life so much for granted, but there's only a sort of a invisible thin line of maybe just a moment which separates the life from death. And suddenly when somebody just dies, you know, it jolts us out. Is this what I'm living for? Real? What is it actually? Or worse still, if there are natural calamities, when suddenly sometimes, you know, a whole locality or a whole city gets wiped off. But that also shakes our faith in the reality of the world that we are experiencing right now. And you know, what causes people trauma is that. When it, you know, for example, when there are some natural disasters like tsunamis or earthquakes, you know, the whole city was there, and in a few fateful moments, the city just gets reduced to rubble. It's just gone. You know, change is always disorienting. But when change is gradual, the disorientation is less. But when the change is sudden and thorough, it is not just disorienting, it is devastating. And when such moments come up, even ordinary people start thinking, is the life that I'm experiencing for real? Or as Shakespeare said, the world is a stage, you know, and the life is just like a drama in it. So this sort of thoughts come to different people. So in the Greek philosophy, Socrates was such a thinker, and he came up with a cave metaphor. So it's a metaphor which illustrates how we are experiencing the shadows of life. So he says, visualize a person who is tied in a cave with his face facing the wall of the cave. So he can't turn around and see. Now the cave is here and his face is facing the wall, and behind there is the sun. And the entrance is coming from the light is coming from the sun. And when the light comes in, the cave is sort of a little bit underground. So when people pass by, when people walk by, the shadows of those people fall on the wall which this person is facing, the bound person is facing. So he just sees these shadows passing by, And he feels, yes, there is something more, there is something higher. But what is it, who all are there, and how I can get there? The person doesn't know anything about it. So his idea was that all of us are shackled in an unreal existence. And we have to move some way towards the real existence. So there are other philosophers also who have come up with similar conceptions. So in the Vedic scriptures, this Urdhva Moolam Adhashakam, upside down tree, is one metaphor. Are there any other metaphors that you know of which talk about how this life that we are living is unreal? Dream. Yes. Tree metaphor. Which one? That is the 10th canto. Actually, tree metaphor. Basically, it's talking about how this world is like a tree. That's one metaphor. Puranjana itself, also stories there. Forest of material enjoyment is there. Narad Muni. Yeah. He gives those two, Haryashwas and Baulashwas. He talks about the ocean and a hole in the ground in which once somebody goes, nobody comes back. So these are metaphors. They are not very elaborately developed metaphors, although they are given. You know, one common metaphor is like a dream. This life is like a dream. And just as when we are dreaming, we feel the world to be, whatever we are experiencing to be real, but as soon as we wake up, it's over. So similarly, there is the whole, like I talked about the metaphor of, one common metaphor I talk about is virtual reality. This is a more contemporary metaphor. So dream is there, then the common example also is mirage, isn't it? So all these metaphors try to convey to us that this world is insubstantial and we have to go beyond this world to some higher reality. So what is distinctive about the Vedic wisdom tradition is that we are not only told that this world is insubstantial, but we are given a clear understanding of the substantial world, of the real substance, what it is. And we are also given a method by which to go from illusion to reality. This is a fundamental difference between the Abrahamic religions and the Dharmic religions. You remember I talked, there are two broad divisions of religions. So in the Abrahamic religions, in general, there is no systematic, sustained sadhana for people to do, to move from this world to the higher world. They have some prayers, and there have been some monks and saints who have constantly prayed to God. But in general, for the common people, there has been no systematic process of sadhana by which people can move from this world towards God. Now, in Dharmic tradition, we have nihilistic or nihilistic religions. Nihilistic means those which reject everything higher. Reject the tradition. Buddhism, Jainism, which also have rigorous sadhana. See, for going from illusion to reality, we need a clear conception of the reality and we need a process by which to move from illusion to reality. So, in the Abrahamic religions, there is neither the clear conception of reality nor a process. There's primarily faith. Have faith in Jesus and you will be saved. Have faith in God and He will deliver you. In the Dharmic religions, in Buddhism and Jainism, the process is there. They perform a lot of austerities and sadhana. But the conception of the absolute truth is not at all clear. It's just shunya. In Mayavad, in impersonalism, the process is rigorous. But again, the conception of the absolute truth is not clear. Only in the Vaishnava path, in Vaishnavism, Vaishnava personalism, is the process clear and the conception of the reality also clear. That's what makes the process very powerfully transformational. Now, there are many religious processes in the world, but not many people can so easily break free from bad habits and become so thoroughly devoted to God the way it happens within Krishna consciousness, because we have a very strong process, very clear process, and a very attractive conception of the absolute truth. So now Krishna is talking not about the reality so much, he's talking about the bondage within the illusory world. So how the soul moves from one body to another is Vayur Gandhani Vashayat. And now in the previous verse, in 15.7, Krishna had talked about the mana. So now, in the next verse, he will describe how that mana plays a significant role in the process of transmigration. Mana Shrotram Chakshu Sparshanam Cha Rasanam Ghranam Eva Cha Rasanam Ghranam Eva Cha Adhishthaya Manashchayam Adhishthaya Manashchayam Vishayanupasevate. So, the five senses are described, the five primary knowledge acquiring senses are described. Shrotram, Chakshu. Shrotram is ears. Chakshu is eyes. Sparshanam is touch. Rasanam, taste. And Granam is smelling. So now, actually in Ambarish Maharaj's prayers also, Savai Manaha Krishna Padaravinde, it talks about all these senses can be used in Krishna's service. Karmendriya Ganendriya. So he's saying these five senses are there. Now they are centered around the mind. Adhishthaya Manashchayam. So just like the palm is the center of the five fingers, like that the mind is the center of the five senses. That means the input from all the senses comes to the mind. Adhishthaya Manashchayam. You know, even in modern neurology, it's a great mystery how all the sensory inputs get integrated. They have no idea about this. Have I discussed this earlier anytime? Now, for example, now, if I see a parrot flying by over here. Now, when I see the parrot, at that time, I see multiple things. I see the shape of the parrot, then I see its color, then I see its motion, and maybe I hear its chirping. So there are four different inputs. There is the motion, there is the shape, there is the color, and there is the sound. Now, scientists have found out that when these inputs, now three are visual inputs, one is audio input. But even the visual inputs, when they enter through the eyes and go through the optic nerve to the brain, the areas of the brain that receive and process the inputs of motion, the inputs of color, and the inputs of shape, they are different. They are not one. And the area which perceives audio inputs is also different. Now, there is no one area in the brain which is connected to all the other areas. So, physically, it is not possible that one area of the brain can integrate all the inputs. But still, that integration happens. When we see a parrot movie, we don't see, oh, I saw a green color and I heard a sound and I heard, oh, it's a parrot. No, you know, we can get a conception of what the asynchronized input would be if you have a homemade video. Somebody just made a video recording of some program or something and they put together. And then the video is there and they have later on put audio on it and the audio and video are not synchronized together. So what happens is somebody is, maybe they are saying that maybe it's some event that is happening. So the event gets over and afterwards the audio comes up. Or sometimes even before the event is happening, the audio comes up. You know, sometimes say there is somebody's, the fist fight is there. And if somebody punches a fist, the person falls down and then after that, you hear the sound. So, or sometimes even before the person has moved the fist, you hear the sound. So that asynchronized input would make a complete mess of things. Now, it never happens in real life that our input is asynchronous. So, it's a great mystery in consciousness studies and neurology where this integration of all the sensory inputs takes place. So, as far as modern science is concerned, they have no answer to this. They say it's an unsolved mystery. In fact, you know, this science magazine, in 2004 or 5, something like that, they put a list of 100 things that science doesn't know. 100 unanswered questions of science. The biggest mysteries in science. The number one was, where does the universe come from? And the number two is, what is consciousness and how does it emerge? So these two are, you know, directly, they are related to the God and soul. So these fundamental questions are still unanswered in science. And even scientists know that they are unanswered. They acknowledge it. So one of the problems with consciousness is even if somehow we assume that consciousness emerges from the brain. But still, we perceive consciousness as a unity, as one conscious experience. So how that integration takes place is a great mystery. So that, this answer is Adhishtaya Manashchayam. The mind is the integrating device. So just like I was talking about the virtual reality. So in the virtual reality, suppose somebody is riding a bike. That means riding a bike, at that time, say the biker is going along and he hears the wind whistling in the ears, or hears the honking of somebody coming from the front. So now, in a virtual reality setup, one may actually be able to feel all that also. One may feel the wind whistling, or one may hear the sound. So, but all that we perceive on the computer screen. The computer screen which is giving the virtual reality. So, the mind is the integrating device. The mind is like the screen of the computer. The mind is the screen which integrates everything and makes it available for us to see. So, if you want to read more about it, Dhritakarmapu has written an article about this. It is based on the Puranjan analogy. Yeah. The mind might be compared to a multimedia computer software capable of integrating audio and visual materials into a single display, making use of a variety of inputs and source materials. So all these inputs come together, the audio and visual inputs, they come together from the various sources and they are integrated together and made available for us. So Adhishtaya Manashchayam Vishayan Upasevati. Now let's move forward. Any questions about this? So let's go to the next verse. Adhishtata basically means supervisor, or in today's language, boss. You know, Adhishtaya. So the mind is like the boss of all the senses. In the 10th chapter also, if you remember, Krishna says, Indriyana Manaschasmi. Among the senses, I am the mind. He said that Anuruddha is the personified deity of the mind. Yes, that's true. That is, the different parts of the body are controlled by different devatas. So, Vasudev, Sankarsana, Ayudhya, Pradyumna, this Chaturviva, they control the four aspects of the subtle body. So, the four aspects of the subtle body are mind, intelligence, ego, and this is told as Chitta. Chitta, as you remember, is the projected consciousness. So, remember Chit and Chitta, I told the difference. Chitta is my normal consciousness. Chitta is the consciousness that is projected into the virtual reality. So, each of these is controlled by one aspect of Vishnu. So, they are basically predominating deities or controlling deities for each of these faculties that shape our interaction with the body. See? Yeah, but in general, the demigods are also supervised by specific manifestations of the Supreme Lord. So, generally speaking, just as Jiva Goswami explains in Brahma Samhita commentary, and other places also, Madhvacharya also talks about this, that, you know, Indra is not just the name of a devata Indra. Indra, Lord Vishnu is also called as Sarvanamavan. Sarvanamavan. He is the possessor of all names. So, Indra, in a sense, you know, is connected with a manifestation of Lord Vishnu whose name is also Indra. See, Indra doesn't have to be the name of a devata only, because Indra basically means controller. So Indra can be the name of even the Supreme Lord. So each of these devatas, you know, they are connected, just like we say Vasudev, Lord Shiva meditates on Sankarsana. So that's what the Bhagavatam says. Similarly, each of these demigods are connected with a sort of their Aradhya Dev. Like in Gayatri, when you chant the Gayatri Mantra, apparently we are praying to Suryadev. But Suryadev has his Aradhya form of Narayan, which is called a Suryanarayan. So when we are meditating on Gayatri, we are not just meditating on Suryadev. When chanting Gayatri, we are actually meditating on Suryanarayan. So like that, each of the Devtas is connected with the Supreme Lord. The particular manifestation of the Supreme Lord, who also has the same name. So whenever the scriptures sometimes seem to glorify that particular Devta as Supreme, occasionally that sort of verses come up. So actually, that is a reference not to that particular Devta, but to be the form of Vishnu who is having that name and who is connected with this particular Devta. This particular Devta has the name of that particular deity. It's a whole complex subject about demigod worship. We'll take it some other time. Let's focus on 15th chapter here right now. So, let's go to the next verse. Utkramantam sthitam vapi bhunjanam vagunanvitam bhunjanam vagunanvitam vimudhananupashyanti pashyanti jnana chakshushah. So, utkramantam sthitam vapi. Utkramantam means to leave, sthitam means to stay. So how a living entity leaves the body or stays in the body, all this happens gunanvitam. So this is the connection with the 14th chapter. Actually, the whole material existence in the 14th chapter was gunatraya vibhaga yoga, about the three modes. So actually those three modes nourish and cause the tree of material existence to grow. They cause this illusory existence to gunapravruddha vishaya pravala, to flourish. So the existence of the living entity in this world is subordinate to the modes, gunanvitam. So utkramantam sitamapi bhunjanam. The soul is thinking that he's enjoying, but actually he's being forced to do this, do that, stay in this body, go from this body to that body. Gunanvitam vimudha nanupashyanti. The deluded soul cannot see all this. But pashyanti jnana chakshushaha. So we may say that I don't perceive how this whole mechanism is happening and soul is interacting with our soul is transmigrating. He says, yes, those who are vimudhas cannot perceive, but by jnana chakshu we can perceive. So that jnana chakshu Krishna will give from 12th to 15th. But on hearing this verse, Arjuna gets the question, what differentiates some people so that some people have a jnana chakshu, some people don't have a jnana chakshu? Why can some people see, why can some people not see? That Krishna answers in the next verse. Yatanto yoginashchainam pashyantyatmanyavasthitam yatanto apyakrutatmano nainam pashyantyachetasah. So yatanto means to endeavor, yatna karna, endeavor. So both people are endeavoring. The one who is those who see and those who don't see. So Krishna is not talking here about materialistic people. No, he's talking about people who are trying to perceive the soul. The vimudha, they don't see only. But some people, if I say, I want to see the soul, I want to understand how all this is happening. So who will be able to see, who will not be able to see? Yatanto yoginashchainam. The yogi who pashyanti, he sees when atmanya avasthitam. When that person situates himself at the spiritual platform. So now this seems a little paradoxical. To see the soul, you have to situate yourself on the spiritual platform. What does that mean? To situate on the spiritual platform doesn't necessarily mean become spiritual, realized, self-realized, or become completely spiritual. It means that situate oneself on a platform which is conducive to spiritual perception, which is conducive to spiritual realization. For example, now we follow the four regulative principles. We do sadhana bhakti. All this facilitates the development of a spiritual vision. On the other hand, yatanto api akruta atmano. One who doesn't do the activity that will situate oneself on the spiritual platform, nainam pashyanti achetasaha. Such a person's consciousness is misdirected. Achetasaha. That's why such a person will not be able to see. So what does akruta atmano mean? Akritatmano means the person continues to live at a materialistic level. And at just a, if just a theoretical level a person tries to perceive, then it cannot, it's not possible. Srila Prabhupada would give the example that if a person is blind, then the blind person, just by yatanto, by endeavor, the person cannot start seeing. Then, yes, will, you know, sometimes in our modern society, just the willpower or sincerity or determination are overemphasized. So willpower is good, it's important, it's in many ways essential. But if I am blind, just by willpower, just by desiring or wanting, I cannot start seeing. If I'm serious, yes, then I should want it, and along with that, I should also go to a doctor who can cure me. There has to be a process by which when my eyes get cured, then I can start seeing. So just willpower, yatanto alone is not enough. The krutatmano, not akrutatmano, one has to become krutatmano. Krutatmano is, one has to situate oneself in a process by which one can see this. And that process is the process of sadhana bhakti. Or even if not sadhana bhakti, some kind of sadhana by which one can start seeing. So that is the difference between these two categories of people. Both may want to see, but if they don't follow the process, then they can't see. Only those who follow the process, they can see. Then, now at this stage, Arjuna gets the question that, okay, if people are not yet ready to follow the process, they are still materialistic, then how will they actually understand that there is a higher reality at all, beyond the material reality? Perceiving that higher reality will come later, but how will they understand that there is a higher reality actually, which we need to perceive? So Krishna says that actually you can see that higher reality with jnana, glimpses of that higher reality, even in this world. If we look at this world carefully, we'll start perceiving things that point to the higher reality. Then he says, how Krishna maintains us even in this material world. Yeah. So, now we're talking about Jnana Chakshu over here. How Krishna assists us in our material existence and our spiritual endeavor. This is the Jnana Chakshu that Krishna will give us. So, yadadityagatam tejo jagadbhasayate akhilam jagadbhasayate akhilam yachandramasi yachagnau yachagnau tattejo vidhimamakam tattejo vidhimamakam yad adityagatam tejo adityagatam, like this, the sun. What does sun do? It illuminates the world. It illuminates the universe. Jagat bhasyate akhilam yachandramasi yachagnau. These same three elements which Krishna talked about in 15.6. The sun, the moon and the fire. These three illuminate this world. And Krishna says, where does this their illuminating potency come from? It comes from me. Tattejo vidhi mamakam. So how can we develop the jnana chakshu? Okay, I don't know anything spiritual, I don't care for anything spiritual, but even if I want to survive and enjoy in this material world, I need arrangements for that. And those arrangements are made by some higher design, some higher intelligence. So by looking at the universe and the world around us, and Krishna will talk about later about our own body, we can see that there is a higher arrangement. And that higher arrangement will prompt our attention towards a higher reality. What is the higher reality beyond this world? So that's how we can begin. Even materialistic people, especially those who live close to nature, those who live in cities, we often don't see how much we, for our needs, are dependent on arrangements beyond the human. You know, for example, when power goes off, immediately we think, okay, let's call some mechanic or some specialist or call the power supply agency. We just think that we live in a world which has been created by humans. And that's why we think that for everything we depend on humans. But if we live close to nature, we understand that there is much that humans cannot fix. You know, if rains don't come, you cannot just call a
plumber and tell the tap is not working, please fix it.
Cannot do anything like that. So we can very easily sense that there is a higher power which is shaping us, shaping our lives in a very, very critical, even decisive way. So Krishna will talk about four aspects over here in, when we look at the arrangements. So what are these arrangements? Let's talk about. This is 15.12 to 15. So the 12th verse talks about the arrangement at the cosmological level. 13th verse will talk about the arrangement at the terrestrial level. Terrestrial means earthly level. 14th will talk about at the bodily or the physiological level. And 15th will talk at the spiritual level.
Material world.
So Jnana Chakshu was what was needed, and we get this by looking at this world in a very thoughtful way. So cosmological arrangement, so the sun and the illumination the sun provides is a representation of the whole arrangement that is required for us to survive in this universe. So cosmological level. And let's look at the next level, what Krishna talks about.
Gama vishya cha bhutani
dharayamyahamojasa pushnami cha aushadhi sarva somo bhutvarasatmakah. And so he's talking about two things. First is the earth and the moon. So the earth is, how is it suspended in space? How does it exist just floating around? Now, science may call it gravity. And, you know, in science, this is a little interesting. We'll discuss this because this is related to the topic. You know, in science, there is this whole discussion of description versus explanation. Does science describe nature or does science explain nature? Now, what is the difference between description and explanation? So, yeah. Yes, perfect. Describe is how, and explain is why. So now, if I talk about this, so if for example Newton said that, why are the planets moving in their particular orbits around the sun? Because of the force of gravity. Now what is gravity? The force that causes planets to move around the sun. So now what has actually been explained here? Isn't it? So, if you go down to the roots, nothing has really been explained. So, when Newton himself was asked this question, how do you perceive that some force is almost like mystically going through empty space or thousands of miles and acting from one object to another object? So, he said, I don't know that. He said, I am not talking about the cause of this force. I am simply giving a mathematical formulation to explain observed phenomena. So he's not actually, he's saying that I'm mathematical formulation, not to explain, to describe observed phenomena, to map. Okay, this is the, if you want to find how much force this object will act on the exertion, this is the equation, this is how it will work. So he did not go into the origin. Now, within science, because there are often multiple explanations for the same phenomena, so therefore, science often, when it goes down, it just, we are just giving theories or models to explain what we observe. But are those models descriptions of, are those models actually the reality? Is that how things are actually? That scientists don't know.
See, this is a little technical, but it's interesting.
Again, in science, there is the instrumental view versus the realist view. What does this mean, instrumental view? That science, is it actually giving us real description of the world as it is? Or it is just a model for us to explain how things work? It's instrumental. Means it's useful for calculating things. Now, it's when Newton proposed, he actually considered that we may not know, but whatever science was, it's actually real. Let me say, now I have this particular matter. It's made of atoms. Atoms are ultimately, go down there, electrons, and there are subatomic particles. So now, that is what the normal understanding was, starting from Newton onwards to Dalton, who proposed atoms, indivisible atoms, and then Rutherford split the atoms, and things went on in the history of science like that. But when the theory of quantum physics came up, according to quantum physics, there is no such thing as gross matter. Everything is ultimately just waves. So, and then there is probability functions, and the Schrodinger's equation causes the wave to collapse. You don't have to go into the whole concept. But the important point is, these two are very radically different conceptions of the world. One is, it's made of Einstein's relativity theory requires solid particles to be exist. Whereas, quantum physics says there are only waves. Now, what is it actually? It can either be waves or it can be particles. Now, the problem with this is that both work. You know, if workability was the criteria for deciding what is real, then you say which theory works, which theory doesn't work. Actually, both theories work. So then it becomes even more difficult. So which theory is a reality? Because the two theories are contradictory. So then, because of this, most scientists today consider that science is not giving us any idea of reality. Science basically provides us models for looking at things. And through those models, we can make things work. We can measure, we can quantify, we can predict. But are these models coinciding with reality? Nobody knows and nobody can know. So some scientists propose that actually these are two models, and below these models, there is some actual reality which science will reach in future. But who knows, if you come to that, what we call as a reality, that might also be a model only. So there is no way that through science we can actually arrive at reality. That's why, what science, now science may say that, okay, planets are floating because of gravity. Gravity is a conception which has been created as a description for what science observes. What scientists have observed and what we also observe. But is it the actual reality? No one knows. So in Krishna is telling, Gama vishyache bhutani dharyami hamojasa. He's telling that it is I who sustain the planet Earth. Now, at our level, we might perceive with our human current level of science that we call that as gravity. But there has to be an original cause because of which things happen. And that cause is the energy of Krishna. So these two explanations, see, when we don't have to, when we are talking about this, this doesn't mean we are saying science is wrong. Now, science is a valid way of looking at the world, but it is not a complete way of looking at the world. There's a difference between valid and complete. Something can be valid without being complete. So science works to whatever extent it works, and we accept it. So the instrumental view, which is what science, instrumental view, is valid but not complete. It works at a particular level, but it is not complete. And the reality is something different. Therefore, the scientific and spiritual views are not contradictory, but are complementary. Contradictory means this is right and that is wrong. No, they're not contradictory. okay, this is, you perceive reality at a particular level, we'll see it like this. But if you perceive it at a deeper level, we perceive it differently. So how many levels deeper can one go? In science, we don't know. But the scripture gives us at the deepest level. The deepest level is actually the energy of God. That's why, in a sense, that only when science claims to have a monopoly on truth, then science comes in conflict with reality, with scripture or spirituality. But when we accept science as a model, it works. And as an instrumental way of looking at things, it is fine. So what do I mean? I'll conclude this with an example of what I mean by instrumentally. See, if I want to come from, say, Pune to Mumbai, and I'm driving my own vehicle, I need a map. A map is a representation of the territory. But the map is not the territory. So if I want to move around Maharashtra and I have a map of it. So a map, if I mistake the map to be the territory, then I can commit a serious mistake. But the map is useful. So the map is like an instrument for me to move around the territory. So just like map is an instrument, similarly, every scientific theory, every scientific model, it's like a map. It's a map of the territory. The territory is the reality of nature, what it is. So, actually, in any scientific theory, science has to shortlist what it will observe. Just like if I'm going to make a map. In a map, I cannot depict everything. If I want to depict a roadmap from, say, of Maharashtra, so go from various places, then on that roadmap, I will focus on those characteristics which are pertinent for road journey. So if there is a big building somewhere, for the roadmap, the height of the building may not be relevant. The color of the building is not relevant. The number of people living in that building is not relevant. So whenever I make a map, I choose the purpose. What am I looking for? Focus on that, and then on that shortlisted set of parameters, I create a representation of the territory. That's the map. Similarly, within science, actually, if science looks at nature, if scientists look at nature, there is so much to observe. So what scientists do is they shortlist certain parameters. These are parameters that we want to observe. And based on these parameters, they create a model. So, with those parameters, the model is valid as far as it goes. But those parameters are not the exhaustive list of features of nature, and that's why they don't describe the reality completely. For example, now if I want to come from Pune to Mumbai to meet a friend in Mumbai, and I have a map, and then every time I follow the map, okay, turn left, here there is a river, you have to cross the bridge, here there will be a red signal, there will be a crossroad, here there will be a national highway. And the more I follow the map, I develop my faith in the map more and more. Because everything that it predicts works. And finally, by following the map, I come to Mumbai. And the map guides me, and I come to my friend's house, and I knock on the friend's house. I look at the door. Okay, so I knock on the friend's house. And when I open the door and I see the friend. Oh, welcome, he says. And I look at my map. My map doesn't show you. Therefore, you don't exist. Well, this is stupid. Your brain doesn't exist. You know? The map is valid. But I shouldn't have developed so much trust in the map that I give up my common sense because of my faith in the map. Isn't it? So like that, what has happened in today's world is that material science focuses on material parameters. And when we move through material parameters more and more and more, then scientists, okay, they study nature and they find, okay, there are material parameters. They look at the body, they find material parameters. Then you look within the body and you find there are mechanisms which make it work. Then finally you come to consciousness, and then how do you make sense of consciousness with matter? Yeah, you can't make sense. Then there are some scientists who say consciousness doesn't exist only. You know, actually speaking, this is the most ridiculous argument. Because to say consciousness doesn't exist, somebody has to be conscious. Isn't it?
So it's like saying that you use a map so much and develop so much faith in the map that you lose common sense because of that. That's what unfortunately happens because of science sometimes. So it's not because of science, it's because of excessive faith in science. An honest scientist, an intelligent scientist will recognize the limitations of science. And there's a map which is a science as far as it goes, a very powerful map. And it works in many ways. But what makes the mistake is when we extrapolate it beyond its jurisdiction. So these two views are complementary, they're not contradictory. So now Krishna is saying, Pushnami Chaushadi Sarva Somo Bhutva Rasatmakaha. That the moon nourishes the Pushnami what? Aushadha, the vegetables. The scientists know that photosynthesis is required. They say they have the idea the sun is required for the vegetation to grow. That is true, but sun does not determine the juicy content of vegetables. Sun basically makes sure that the photosynthesis takes place by the vegetables or by basically plants grow. So there have been some experiments done. This is as of now in the tentative stage. Scientists have found, and in general all traditional farmers know, that the growth of their crops is determined not just by the rains, not just by the sun, but also by the night sky. Generally farmers say that actually with the night sky with bright moon, then somehow the crops that grow are much richer. They are much better. The vegetables, the fruits, all these grow much better. So now scientists have done some research and they have found that the condition of the overhead sky at night and the amount of, say, moonlight present in it makes a difference. There are tentative stages, but science has in any way disproved it. Science has just not researched this adequately. But we understand from the scriptures that the moon is aushadhi, that the moon actually is the demigod in charge of the mind, and is also the demigod in charge of the vegetables, the plants and the vegetables. That's why we'll see in the fourth canto as well as the eighth canto, where the prachitas pastime comes along, and the prachitas burn up the plants because of their anger. At that time, the moon god comes, and moon god gives his daughter to the prachitas. And then he says that I am in charge of the trees in the forest. Don't burn it up, please. So he comes to the rescue. The point is, Pushnami Chaushadhi Sarva. So irrespective of what, whether science finds a mechanism or not, we understand that there is a higher causal principle that is involved. And Krishna is telling that the moon has the capacity to nourish the vegetables, and that capacity is made by my arrangement. So this is the terrestrial arrangement, what is we see on the earth. And then the physiological within the body. Aham Vaishvanaro Bhutva, Vaishvanaro Bhutva, Praninam Deham Ashritaha, Praninam Deham Ashritaha, Pranapana Samayuktaha, Pachamyannam Chaturvidham. So Vaishvanar is the devata in charge of the digestion. So, you know, God gives and forgives, we get and forget. That is our condition, you know. That means we have a digestive power. We don't think about the digestion till the time it stops working. Isn't it? Every day we eat and we think that, okay, I'm eating, I'm enjoying. But when researchers trying to make artificial bodily parts, so if my hand is broken, then I may get artificial limb, like that. So a common problem nowadays is digestion. So scientists thought that, you know, if a person has bad digestion, can we just if you have a pacemaker for a person who his heart doesn't function properly, or there's a dialysis unit for somebody whose kidney doesn't work properly. So can we create an artificial digestive machine? As if a person not able to digest food, just put that machine inside, and that machine will digest the food for that person. And then they started it, and they found that the whole mechanism of digestion is so complex that a machine would not be enough. You'll need a factory. And not just a factory, but a chain of factory that would extend 2 miles long. Now maybe with nanotechnology that miles may be lesser. But still, the point is, they realize there's a whole
complex mechanism. And then the bigger problem that they came up was that it's not just you need such a big factory, just the length of the factory itself is complex. But along with that, you know, when there is a factory, you have to have a conveyor belt along, you have to move the whole thing along that conveyor belt. Isn't it? So they found that the amount of processing that happens in the alimentary canal when food gets digested should require a huge amount of work to be performed for that. Now, if you know mechanics, it says work is force into distance. So, you know, if I have to push something over a longer distance, it requires I'm doing a lot of work. If I have to carry a luggage for 1 meter, it's not a big thing. Carry this back for 1 kilometer, you know, the force and the distance is much more, so it becomes more. So they found that actually the work required to digest one morsel of food, I take one handful of food and eat it, and when that morsel goes through the alimentary canal from the top to the bottom, the work required in that is more than the work that an average human being performs throughout the day. So actually, who is performing that work? You know, we just eat the food and we forget it. But the amount of work required in digestion is huge. And who is doing it? Aham Vaishvanaro Bhutva. It is actually the Supreme Lord who is doing that. He has made all the arrangements. Prana, Pana, Samayukta. Now, we may not know through modern science what is this mechanism. Prana, Pana. There is a different model of looking at it. The different airs in the body, they move, and that's how digestion happens. Modern science has the idea of this, there is a diastolic motion. Then the alimentary canal contracts and expands. Peristalsis, they call it, by which this whole thing happens. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is through the motion of the airs. So, Krishna is telling that Dehama Ashritaha, the soul takes shelter of the body in order to enjoy this world and to live in this world. But actually, this body is sheltered by my arrangement. I am the ashray of the body. And Pachami Annam Chaturvidham. Krishna uses the word Chaturvidham specifically. Why? This four, because you know, these are the different kinds of food that we eat. We get pleasure through that. Food that is chewed, sucked, swallowed, licked, all that. Different kinds of food. Chaturvidham. So actually it's Krishna who is maintaining our body. And it's by whose arrangement that we are able to live and enjoy in this body. So in this way, when we understand that it is Krishna who is the maintainer, even for our material life, then we start feeling gratitude towards Krishna. So, you know, when a person wants to even enjoy sense gratification, actually, who has created the arrangement for sense gratification for us also? You know, the Ravana tells Sita, Ravana is trying to, you know, when a man wants to allure a woman, he allures her by praising her beauty. So, what Ravana tells her, he says, Sita, you are so beautiful that I think that after creating you, the creator must have retired. Because he felt that he could not make anyone more beautiful than you. So see, even a demon like Ravana understand that I did not create the beauty of Sita. There is some creator who created the beauty of Sita. But he thinks that that beauty is not meant for that creator, it's meant for me. Isn't it? That beauty is meant for my enjoyment. So, you know, long ago in a Bollywood song, Bollywood movie, there was a song which said the same Ravana theme. You know, that song was what? Tareef karu ke ja uski jisne tumhe banaya. So, this is typical Ravana mentality. Isn't it? So, you think, okay, that means the point which we are discussing is even material sense gratification, if you want, we have to depend on Krishna's arrangement. You know, the beautiful sense objects are not made by us. They are made by Krishna. So, this vision helps us understand that even for material enjoyment, we depend on Krishna. That's a dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Even when I want kama, that has to be preceded by dharma. If I have to acknowledge the reality of this world. So by this jnana chakshu, we understand that for my survival and for my enjoyment in this world, I am dependent on Krishna's arrangement. In the next verse, Krishna will talk about how the purpose of existence is not just survival and enjoyment in this world, it is returning back to the spiritual world. And how Krishna will give the spiritual knowledge, we'll talk in the next verse. We'll discuss that tomorrow, on Monday. Yes, Ram? So if somebody has digestion problem, will the worship of these particular deities solve the problem? Akama sarva kama vada. Bhagavatam says that you know, whatever, whether we have particular desire or not, just worship Lord Vishnu. So we don't know what is Krishna's plan for how he wants to purify and elevate us. So certain problems may just stay on. So rather than focusing on the solution of a particular problem, you know, the process of devotional service focuses on the solution to the whole problematic material existence itself. So, but it is true, you know, sometimes some couples are unable to conceive. So at that time, they go to some astrologers or something like that. So now, there are devotee astrologers, you know, and the normal astrologer will tell you worship a particular devta. But the devotee astrologers, they tell that those particular devatas are subordinate to particular forms of the Supreme Lord. So then when they are told you worship that Supreme Lord, that form of the Supreme Lord. So then by that worship also one can correct those astrological problems and get the results. But as devotees, we depend ultimately on Krishna's will, and we don't demand to Krishna that you correct this problem. But that is the way that Gopal Bhatta Goswami in Hari Bhakti Vilas has spiritualized the karmakandi samskars. You know, many times if you see a yajna that is performed, when Vaishnava yajnas are performed, instead of doing worship of all the devatas, we do the worship of the great devotees and the forms of the Lord who are in charge of those devatas. So that can be done. If one has some specific problems, then one can worship the Supreme Lord, the particular manifestation of the Supreme Lord. So the whole process of devotional astrology is centered on this principle itself. Okay. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Bhaktavinda ki jai. Pita Gaur Premanandhi. Thank you. Prabhupada ki jai.